making another observation or two about chapter 12. And then we'll get into chapter 13 this morning. In chapter 12, as we said, it's easy to follow the theme line, even though there may be some things about it that God did not reveal, and some things that He did that is kind of hard for us to understand or comprehend. But the theme is quite clear, as this woman has a son, and this dragon wants to kill it. And God saves the woman, and He saves the son. And so, evidently, in the story, it stands for the birth of Jesus and how that God made sure that the Savior of the world was spared destruction by the devil. There was no way that God was going to allow that to happen. And we said that you can focus and say that the woman is Mary, or you can sort of just say it's sort of the Lord's ancestors, the Jewish nation, because the New Testament does talk about how that God used the Jews to get the gospel to the whole world. Romans chapters 9 through 11. He uses Jews and He uses Gentiles. Jews became hardened that He might bring the Gentiles in. And so you've got that discussion. So, and Jesus would say to the woman of Samaria, salvation is from the Jews. And Romans 9, they are beloved for the Father's sake. Now, they're enemies for Christ's sake. So many of the Jews persecuted the first century church, or they stayed outside and they impeded progress. But given the scheme of redemption and God's use of Jacob and Israel, and then all of those that came along, He says they are beloved for the Father's sake. So you have to work with all of that. Now, if you look at it that way, that the woman represents all of the ancestry of Jesus Christ so that His credentials could be established, then, of course, when He persecutes the woman, that would be a reference to the persecution of the Jews in this chapter. And then when you get down to the rest of her seed in verse 17, that will be the persecution of the saints, the church, the rest of those people that keep the commandments of God. So it doesn't really matter whether you think about Mary or you think about the Jews. The same thing basically holds for all. All right, now in chapter 13, we get to the beast. Now, Seth, would you hand out this very brief outline? There are just two big points in this chapter. Two main sections. That's why the outline is so brief. It's not that it's not important. It's very important, but the way that this section of Scripture is arranged, there are two vital points that John is making with regard to certain persons. Now, the King James might have "I stood" in verse 1 of chapter 13, but most of the manuscript evidence, at least as taken by the American Standard people, is on the side of putting it in the third person, and he, or the beast, or the dragon, rather, stood upon the sand of the sea. Okay, thank you, sir. All right, now this is the chapter where we get into the mark of the beast. In the first 10 verses, a beast out of the sea wars with the saints. And in the rest of the chapter, a second beast, another beast out of the earth, forces worship of the first beast. Now, when you get into this section, if you remember anything about our study in Daniel, you go back to chapter 7 and 8 of Daniel, and there is a connection between the descriptions that you have of the beast here and what Daniel saw in chapter 7. He sees, but he sees four beasts. Now, as Frank Pack points out, what you have in Daniel, you've got these four kings, four kingdoms. But what you have in Revelation 13, it's a composite. It's a combination of them. It seems like what Daniel was hinting at, was getting at, the kingdoms, as they stand as representatives, maybe against God or whatever. In Rome, you have it all combined. The Roman Empire, that's the first beast. Now in Daniel, you had the first beast that was a lion, was Babylon. The second, a bear, Medo-Persia. The third, a panther, a Macedonian empire. And then the one diverse from all the rest, the Roman Empire. And that's what it seems to be back in Daniel 7. Now in Revelation 13, you just have one beast, but it's characterized by other features that look like other beasts. The leopard with bear-like feet and with a lion-like mouth. So it's reminiscent, it seems, of what Daniel saw so many years before. I saw a beast coming up out of the sea, having 10 horns and 7 heads. And on his horns, 10 diadems. And upon his heads, names of blasphemy. And the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard, and his feet were as a bear, and his mouth as the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power. Now, who was the dragon in chapter 12?
The devil.
So here you have, remember what Jesus was told by the devil, if he would fall down and worship him, what would he do? Give him all the kingdoms of the world. Now you've heard me say on various occasions that he doesn't really own the kingdoms, but he sometimes controls the kingdoms by his influence. It's not legal right, but it is a usurpation of influence, as it were. And so, in Daniel we learn, 2 or 3 times in that book, God gives the kingdoms to whomsoever He will. So God's in ultimate control. But He's making, and Daniel also, we're told, that sometimes He gives the kingdoms to the basest of men. Well, there's the influence of the devil. Key, rotten people being placed in powers of authority. That makes living sometimes quite dangerous and sad and a horrible situation. When evil men rule, you know, people fear. Now the dragon gave him his power, that's the influence of the devil, and his throne and great authority because of his influence. And I saw one of his heads as though it had been smitten unto death. And his death stroke was healed. And the whole earth wondered after the beast. Now, isn't that something? Now, that's the second time we've had something like that said in Revelation. Now, let's go back to chapter 5. This kind of thing was said about Jesus. Chapter 5 and verse 6. And I saw in the midst of the throne and of the four living creatures and in the midst of the elders a lamb standing as though it had been slain, having 7 horns and 7 eyes, which are the 7 spirits. So the first time this kind of imagery came up in the visions of John, it's Jesus. Now, Jesus was killed. We know that in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. We also know that He was raised from the dead. His death stroke was healed. He very much came alive again and went through various post-resurrection appearances. So this seems to be sort of a counterpoint, as it were, to what had happened to Jesus. I'm not saying it's the same thing exactly, but the imagery is sort of like what John had already seen with the lamb. It was a recovered lamb. But here you've got one of the heads, one of the 7 heads of the beast. And one of the heads had been wounded, but now it seems it's healed. And the whole earth wondered after the beast. That's peculiar, isn't it? Very, very peculiar. And because of this, now notice verse 4, and they worshiped the dragon, that's the devil. And they worshiped the dragon because he gave his authority unto the beast. And they worshiped the beast, which is all through the rest of Rome. Anytime you come across beast, It's going to be the Roman Empire or the Caesars. The beast is always, it always has to do. The dragon is the devil, and the beast has to do with Rome. And they worship the beast, saying, "Who is like unto the beast? And who is able to war with him?" And so on and so on. Now, let's come back just a moment and think about this death stroke thing. And it's interesting. Frank Pack referred to this in his little commentaries on Revelation way back in the 1960s. And more recently, Brother West in his little commentary has somewhat to say about it too. And there was, in the first century, now, we don't usually hear about this, I suppose, most of the time, but Nero had died. Nero died. Nero, according to Brother West, became an emperor, a Roman emperor, when he was 17 years old. Now, when did Josiah become a king in the... Well, okay, but now, wasn't he 8 years old, Josiah?
His mother ruled in his place.
Yeah, but he was 8 years old, and until he got older to where he could really, you know, exert some influence. But we have people who are in given families and lineages who have legal rights to the throne, just a matter of... And even Paul will make some point on that in the book of Galatians about somebody that's in authority, but yet he's a child. He's under guardians and stewards until the day appointed. Okay, now Nero had become an emperor at age 17. Now Nero was the one that was on the throne during the time of the, well, at least he was there just before the time of... the destruction of Jerusalem. But Nero had sense enough to listen to advisors, including the Roman Senate, when he first started. But then, like a lot of us do, he gets a little arrogant. And then he decides that he can just kind of launch out on his own and kind of exert himself more independently. And he tries to do that. The Senate decided, evidently, to kill him. To kill Caesar. When he's about 27 years old. Now that's still a very young boy. Young man. 27 years old. And he knows, Nero knows it. And he runs away. And he leaves Rome. Goes. Brother West says he dies in a house about 4 miles outside of Rome. Josephus says that he died in the Roman suburbs. But he tried to commit suicide. And lacking the courage to finish it, he calls on an attendant that he'd taken with him to finish the job. And he died outside of Rome. But there was a rumor that was circulated. Remember, what rumor was circulated about the resurrection of Christ? What rumor was it?
They stole the body.
The body had been taken. It had been stolen. He didn't come up from the dead. And that rumor was circulating when, in the first century, when the Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were being written. That rumor was still out there. Now, Brother West thinks that this has reference to that rumor. Because the rumor was that Nero did not actually die. He recovered from his wounds and he goes to Parthia. Remember, we've already referred to the fact that the Parthians were those who fought on horses more so than the Romans did, and the Romans could not conquer the Parthians. And there was a rumor that was circulated that said that Nero recovered, went to Parthia, he was going to raise him an army and come back and, you know, reassert his authority, as it were. And Brother West thinks that he is really, John is dealing with that rumor right here, which is very, very possible. And that may be the basis of the statement. But I'm going to suggest something else too. And that probably is the case. It may well be the case. This has to do with a rumor about Nero's recovery. But I think it's also possible that there's something more fundamental than that. In Genesis 3:15, in the first messianic promise... When God was talking to the serpent, what does he say? I'm going to put enmity between thee. Now, remember, back in chapter 12, the devil is referred to as what?
Serpent.
Yeah, he in Genesis 3, he uses the serpent. In Revelation 12, he's called the serpent. I'm going to suggest simply that it may well be the case that the death stroke being seen as healed may also refer to the fact that even though Jesus, according to Hebrews 2:14 and 15, had overcome the devil, he'd overcome sin and he took away the power of the devil. He overcame sin and death so that men didn't have to live in fear of death anymore. Now Jesus did that. So, but in Genesis 3:15, I will put enmity between thee and the woman, between thy seed and her seed. It shall bruise thy head and thou shalt bruise his heel. Could it not be some sort of a reference to it looks to the church like, even though Jesus had overpowered the devil with a death stroke to the head, given his influence in the first century and in the persecution of the saints, it looks like the devil's doing pretty good. The devil's doing all right. Like it is a healing from the death stroke. Now you say, yeah, but this is talking about one of the heads of the dragons. Yes, but it also says that they worship the dragon. And if the imagery says that the Romans worship the devil, how did they do that? I don't know that we... Are you aware of any evidence that says there was devil worship in Rome? They worshiped the gods. They had plenty of gods. I think the worship of the dragon, the worship of the devil, is representative by means of the worship of Caesar, the worship of the beast. Now, if that's true, that if the worship of the dragon is representative, then it's also possible that this head of the dragon is representative. And so that I could make my point with regard to Jesus overcoming the devil, It's not just Nero or somebody like that that got well after he got, he was injured or whatever. But more fundamentally, to the Christians, it looks like that he is now reasserting his power in the persecution of the saints. It's a little bit difficult. But anyway, the rumor that circulated evidently is the background for what is said right here. Now, they worship the beast, which is, of course, the Caesars. And there were about seven of those, as Brother West pointed out, from Augustus all the way down to Domitian, that received worship from the Romans, even though it got more... It was escalating. It was getting more widespread by the time of Domitian. Now, so they would... The Romans would think, just like sometimes I'm afraid people in the West have thought about maybe America. Boy, is anybody ever going to be powerful enough to overthrow America? Well, look at China. Things can change so quickly. And who would think that our culture would be in the absolute moral mess that it is now? And who would have thought, back in January, that we would have had the economic problem that we had because of a disease? We could not see that coming. That simply indicates that you just don't always know what a day may bring, as Solomon told us about. But at any rate, so they were thinking, well, the Roman Empire, it's just here. It's here to stay. It's the grandest thing the world's ever seen. And you can fall into that sort of mental trap. And there was given him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies. Now remember, this is the first century. And during the time when the church, through various persons, is performing miracles. And it's during the time of demon possession. So on the other side of the coin, you have supernatural things being accomplished, we read about in Scripture, that are under the power of the devil. Now there's also a reference, and Pack and Brother West do refer to the fact that in the first century, some of the Romans did use ventriloquism in order to deceive people with respect to their gods. And somebody might, speak for a an inanimate object when the worshipers would come or whatever. Maybe somebody would be at a distance and talk as though the gods were saying some things to them. At any rate, there was given him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and there was given him authority to continue 42 months, which of course is the time of the Jewish wars. And he opened his mouth for blasphemies against God, to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle, even them that dwell in the heaven. And it was given unto him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. Now, so you've got two kinds of overcoming. The first one back in chapter 12, verse 11 says the saints overcame their enemy. The saints overcame. Why? Because they loved not their life even unto death. Because of the blood of the Lamb, because of His testimony, because they loved not their lives even unto death. They overcame. So if you're talking about spiritual victory, that's what you have in chapter 12. If you're talking about physical overwhelming, that's what you have right here. They overcame them. That is, they would arrest them. They would put them to death. And there was given to him authority over every tribe and people and tongue and nation, and all that dwell on the earth shall worship him. Everyone whose name hath not been written from the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb that hath been slain. Now, my goodness. Now it's this scene. It's like you have this contest between God and the devil, and right and wrong. And right here in the first century, as far as the saints can see, you know, they're the ones alive at this time. It all centers on us and Caesar. It's all the church and the Roman Empire. That's what it looks like. It's what it feels like to them, no doubt at all. And so, who gets the force of the persecution of Caesar, and who doesn't? Well, you get it if you're a Lamb lover, an obedient Christian, the saints that overcome by His blood. But you get Caesar's wrath. That wrath comes. How does God's power get in here? It comes. God's power is going to come on those whose names are not written. Now, you've got enormous power in political persecution. You know, if a soldier came to arrest you, you would feel tremendous mental agony when you thought you were going to be burned or tortured some other way or thrown to the lions, or your wife was, or your children were. It's hard to imagine the feelings that they felt. Now, Caesar exercises his power. Let's read it again. And all that dwell on the earth shall worship him, everyone whose name hath not been written from the foundation of the world in the book of the life of the Lamb that hath been slain. So if your name was written, that means you're one of those that did not cave in during the first century. That's an incredible thing. You're talking about moving history in the first century, but you're also talking about the omniscience of God throughout eternity and His power in knowing. You know, in one way, we always decipher between His knowledge and His power. But His knowledge is power. His knowledge is a kind of power. And He knows who will be lost and who will be saved. This is why you read in Ephesians 1 and 1 Thessalonians 1 about election. The elect. We are either a part of God's elect and our names have been written in the Lamb's Book of Life from the foundation of the world, or we are not. If our name is there, then of course that means that we're going to heaven. But we don't see the book. We don't see the name. We can't venture to say, I know what the final outcome is going to be in my life yet, because I haven't lived it. And I know what Peter did, and I know what Judas did. I know what Demas did. I know what others, my contemporaries have done. Now I'm trying to hold on. And you're trying to hold on. And the fact is, God knows if we will or we will not. You can't make of this some Augustinian or Calvinistic view of damnation. It has everything to do with the free will of man. But still, it is fixed. It is set. If you used your free will to come to God and live for God, your name is written from the foundation of the world. But if you're one of those that decided not to do that, then of course your name was not in the book. Who are these that are caving into to Caesar worship? Well, every one of them, they've got a name that's not in that book. So it's an incredible thing. We've all heard preachers talk about places where our names are. And there's not one more important. You know, it's on a bank account, maybe on a life insurance policy, maybe on a deed. There are a lot of important places where a name needs to appear. Finally, it appears on a death certificate. Then what's going to happen? Is your name written in the Lamb's Book of Life? Remember, in the book of Revelation, you'll have the Book of Life. You'll have the Water of Life. What else do we have? There's one or two more, aren't there? The Book of Life. Well, Jesus was the bread of life, but that's outside the book of Revelation. The water of life. It seems like there's one or two more, but at any rate, if any man hath an ear, now just like in chapters 2 and 3 in the letters specifically to the churches of Asia, if any man hath an ear, let him hear. And over there it was, let him hear what the Spirit saith through the churches. Now watch this principle. In verse 10 he says, you get as good as you give. All of those who are the enemies of God and want to punish God's people, they get as good as they give. So he says, if any man is for captivity, into captivity he goes. If any man shall kill with the sword must he be killed. John just gives that principle. You're going to receive according to how you live. And all of the persecuting people of the saints of the first century are going to, of course, get justice, as we've already seen in other passages. And so he says, here is the steadfastness and the faith of the saints. What do you mean? Well, when all of these people are for putting you in captivity, when all of these people are for killing you, you have to run your course. Just like Paul says in 2 Timothy 4, my race is run. You've got to run your course. And this is the time for steadfastness, holding on. This is a time for the manifestation of great faith. This is the patience and the faith of the saints. Now, go to 22:11. You have something sort of like what appears in the first part of verse 10. In chapter 22 and verse 11, as John is winding up his book. Now, back here, you know, if you're for captivity, you're going to eventually get captivity. If you're trying to kill the saints, eventually you're going to be punished for your error. Now, notice as he winds up the book, verse 11, he that is unrighteous, let him do unrighteousness still. And he that is filthy, let him be made filthy still. And he that is righteous, let him do righteousness still. And he that is holy, let him be made holy still. So it sort of carries out the picture of it in a way. It's all going to be finished. It's going to be terminated. And each classification of people, the good and the bad, the persecutor and the persecuted, will stand before a righteous God who wanted all men to be saved and for whom His Son, the Lamb, the having recovered Lamb, died. All right. So, now let's see. And I saw another beast. Now this is the second point on the outline in this chapter that we call the Mark of the Beast. And I saw another beast coming up out of the earth. And he had two horns like unto a lamb, and he spake as a dragon. Now go over to chapter 16, verse 13. 16:13. Now here, we've been dealing with the dragon and the beast, the devil and Rome. Now here we have what seems to be the second part of this chapter, identified in chapter 16, verse 13. And I saw coming out of the mouth of the dragon, and out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet, three unclean spirits, as it were frogs. The false prophets seem to be what you have here in verse 11 and following. That's the second beast. Brother West would refer to that as the priesthood. That is, all of those in Rome who were given the assignment to make sure that the citizens worship Caesar. These are those who take care of the sacrifices, make sure you're given a certificate because you've offered sacrifice. You've worshiped Caesar. And so we're going to give you a certificate, as it were. And so these are the ones that seem to be responsible for the carrying out of the mandate that everyone must bow down to Caesar. Now, you imagine you being a Christian in the Roman Empire after that kind of law has been passed, and now you have to go do that or suffer the political and social consequences of that. It gets awfully serious very fast, does it not? So it seems to be the false prophet coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like unto a lamb, and he spake as a dragon. So he looks like a lamb in a way. It's sort of like a religion. Some people think anybody that's religious has to be pretty good. Well, I guess if you represent yourself as religious, you might seem to be nice and kind and lambish. But he speaks like a dragon. So there's a contrast between his looks and his character. And he exerciseth all the authority of the first beast, that's Caesar, or the Roman government. And he maketh the earth and them that dwell therein to worship the first beast, whose death stroke was healed. And so there the death stroke doesn't just stand for one Caesar, but for anyone in power, it seems. And then that may go back to the devil's exercising influence through government. And he doeth great signs. Now, again, as I said a while ago, in the first century you had miracles on God's side, and you could have supernatural activity on the devil's side. We saw that in the spirits. We see it in Acts 16 when that woman had the spirit of a python. And Paul called it the spirit out. Now, if we see that in the Bible, what else was being done that the Bible doesn't record? What happened in Egypt between the attendants of Pharaoh and Moses? When they did certain supernatural things that mimicked what Moses did. I don't just say that they just look like it. I think you get up to a point when the sorcerers in Egypt, I think they were employing supernatural powers to get things done. In cahoots with the devil, they were under influence and they were capable of doing certain things. You get to a point in the contest where their power ends. But up to a point, they turned the rods into snakes. Now, I don't think you can just get away with, having some sort of a serpent that's under some sort of a medical condition and he's stiff for a little while, then all of a sudden he starts wiggling again. I don't think that. I think there were actually devilish powers at work. And then you get to a point where they're not able to go any further with Moses. And I'm simply suggesting that some of this that's referred to here in Revelation may still be drawing on devilish powers at work in the first century. He doeth great signs that he should even make fire to come down out of heaven upon the earth in the sight of men. And he deceiveth them that dwell on the earth by reason of the signs which it was given him to do in the sight of the beast, saying to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image to the beast who hath the stroke of the sword and lived. And it was given unto him to give breath to it, even to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and caused that as many as should not worship the image of the beast should be killed. That part's very, very plain, isn't it? You either become a Caesar worshiper or you pay with your life. So if you don't have the certificate that says you did it, you're in trouble. And he causeth all, the small and the great, and the rich and the poor, and the free and the bond, that there be given them a mark on their right hand or upon their forehead, and that no man should be able to buy or to sell, save he that hath the mark, even the name of the beast or the number of his name. My goodness, that's scary. So you go to buy your groceries, you go to the market, but you don't have a certificate.
You don't have your mask on.
Yeah. You don't have your certificate. Well, you can't buy here. Well, I need to sell this cow. Well, where's your certificate? Yeah, I don't have one. Well, you can't sell here. So it's awful to think that it comes to that in a society. But as surely as we're alive right now, we can contemplate how certain people get in power in this country. That kind of thing could happen to religious people in this country. Because there are plenty of people here right now that don't want the name of God mentioned. They don't want that kind of influence in there right now. And the Supreme Court hears, it'll start Monday. There are people, some people that will be involved in that, that think anybody that's religious is dangerous. You can't count on a religious person. Imagine America becoming like that. When the founding fathers spoke of, you know, how can we succeed if God doesn't help us? And now, if you have any impression of God and you think about God, you can't be fair. You can't be a justice in this country. You've got people like that in government now. Now, I don't think they hold enough influence to get their way in this matter, fortunately. But what if they did? How wicked will God allow the world, our America, to become until He allows that kind of thing to carry? And then religious people have to look out. Not just buying and selling, but, you know, finally even living, maybe. I mean, you say, well, that could never happen. That could never happen. But it can happen. And so you have to have the mark of the beast on your hand or on your head. And the name of the beast, or the number. And here's wisdom. Here's wisdom. Just like verse 10. Here is wisdom. He that hath understanding, let him count the number of the beast. For it is the number of a man. And his number is 666. 666. Now, who in the world is that? Who can say? But he says it's the number of a man. Now, Brother West says in his commentary, he says, I am completely convinced that that's Nero Caesar. Now, he gets there by adding up the numerical value of the Hebrew letters for Nero Caesar. Now, Frank Pack thinks that's far-fetched. Now, Frank Pack wrote first, but he wrote in his commentary that he doesn't even know how Hebrew got into this discussion. But he thinks it's just generally a reference to the Antichrist. The Antichrist. But now Brother West says that if you count up in Hebrew the numerical value of the Hebrew letters, it actually, Nero's name, Nero Caesar, adds up to 666. Frank Pack says that you have to write Nero's name incorrectly to get to that number. So I don't know what to do with that. There's always going to be controversy about it, whether it's Nero or somebody else that comes along. Maybe it is. Maybe it starts with Nero. Maybe it's another Caesar. We're going to have the Antichrist. Now, John mentions in his writings the Antichrist. And it's anyone who has the spirit that's opposed to Christ. He says there have been arisen many antichrists. It's not just one man, but it's many men. It's the number of a man. It doesn't have to be just one man, but it can be many men anyone who stands opposed to Christ. And of course, in the first century, the most obvious and prominent and effective one is Caesar. Now, if you've got his number on your hand or on your head, you get the certificate, you buy and you sell, which means you've worshipped him. If you don't worship him, you don't get the certificate, you can't buy and you can't sell. Okay, it's time to quit. We'll come to chapter 14 next time. Thank you.